Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Russian Empire History Podcast, the history of all the peoples of the Russian Empire. I'm your host, J.P. Bristow. This is Season 1, The Forest, the Steppe, and the Birth of the Russian Empire. Episode 38, Vladimir the Great, Part 3, The Baptism of Rus. First up, thanks to new boyars, Ryan, Roskar, and Fernando, and to new subscribers on Apple Podcasts. I previously mentioned that I was hoping to add some benefits for subscribers on Patreon. That hasn't happened yet because apparently it's not so easy to do so from New Zealand. So instead, I've decided to periodically make a members episode available to state councillors. So if you are on the most affordable tier of support, you can now go and listen to Member Episode 4, The Northern Slave Trade. And while we're on the subject of member episodes, this episode is a bit late to realign my release schedule because I'm switching to a 9-day fortnight at work, which will give me 2 days a month to dedicate to the podcast. I initially promised 8 to 10 member episodes a year and managed 8 in the first 12 months. Hopefully with this extra time, I can get that to over 10. Hopefully with this extra time, I can get that to 10 over the next 12 months. So, on with the show. The tale of bygone years picks up the story a year later. In 988, Vladimir is out campaigning again, laying siege to the Byzantine city of Kherson. The inhabitants, says the tale, resisted energetically. Eventually, they grew tired, and Vladimir warned them that if they did not surrender, he would continue for another 3 years. They ignored him, and Vladimir orders the construction of earthworks. In what must surely be a scribal error, the people of Kherson dig a tunnel out of the city, steal the earth that Vladimir's troops are piling up, and dump it in the city square. Meanwhile, a certain Anastasius attaches a message to an arrow and fires it into the Rus camp. "There are springs behind you to the east," reads the message, "from which water is pumped into town. Dig down and cut them off." When Vladimir hears this, he raises his eyes to heaven and swears that if it is true, he will be baptized. They dig, they find the pipes, and the thirsty inhabitants are soon forced to surrender. Vladimir enters the city in triumph and sends the emperors a message. "Behold, I have conquered your city. I also hear you have an unmarried sister. Give her to me as my wife, or I will treat Constantinople as I have her son." The emperors are troubled because Christians do not give their sisters in marriage to pagans. "If you are baptized, you shall have her to wife, inherit the kingdom of God, and be our companion in the faith. Otherwise, no marriage." Vladimir sends word that he accepts the conditions, since he had already studied the Greek religion. The emperors rejoice, persuade their sister Anna to play her part, and ask Vladimir to get the baptism done first. But Vladimir objects. "Let the princess come and bring some priests to baptize him." The emperors agree and ship their sister off. The happy bride says, "It is as if I were setting off into captivity. Better were it for me to die at home." Her brothers remonstrate that she is the instrument of God who will turn the Rus to repentance and save Byzantium from the threat of war. Anyway, the princess arrives in Kherson. By divine agency, as the tale puts it, Vladimir was suffering from a disease of the eyes and could not see anything. The princess told him that if he wished to be healed, he should be baptized immediately. "If this proves true," says Vladimir, "then the God of the Christians is truly great." the bishop of Kherson and the princess's priests baptize Vladimir, who immediately recovers his sight and celebrates the miracle, as do his men. Quote, Vladimir was baptized in the church of St. Basil, which stands in Kherson upon a square in the center of the city, where the Khersonians trade. The palace of Vladimir stands beside the church to this day, and the palace of the princess is behind the altar. After his baptism, Vladimir took the princess in marriage. Those who do not know the truth say he was baptized in Kiev, while others say in Vasiliev, while others mention still other places. End quote. Seems like there might be a bit of confusion over the story. The priests explain Christianity to Vladimir after he gets baptized, which seems to be the wrong way around, and provokes another extended digression. In between covering the meaning of baptism and the core teachings of the church, the chronicler finds time to deride the Latins, that is, Roman Christians, whose instruction, he says, is vicious, contrary to the teachings of the apostles, and pollutes the earth. Vladimir quickly builds a church, and then gives her son back to the Byzantines as a wedding present for the princess, before leaving for Kiev. Back in Kiev, Vladimir immediately orders his idols torn down. Some he burns, some he chops up. Perun is tied to a horse and dragged to the river, while 12 men beat it with sticks. Not because it can feel anything, but to offend the demon who had deceived men. Bystanders yet to convert cried as they watched it thrown into the Dnieper. With that taken care of, Vladimir sent messengers throughout the city ordering everyone, rich or poor, to get into the river or else. Apparently the people all wept for joy, sure that if the king and boyars were for it, it must be good. And so the next day, the king, his new bride, and the people they had brought from Kherson went to the river where an enormous crowd was gathered. The priests prayed, the people were baptized. The devil fell to the ground and cried out, quote, Woe is me, how I am driven out of here. I thought to have my dwelling place here since the apostolic teachings were not known in the land and the people did not know God, but rejoiced in serving me. But now I am vanquished by the ignorant, not by apostles and martyrs, and my reign in these regions is at an end. End quote. Vladimir celebrates as his people return home and starts building churches and sending out priests. He takes the children of the nobles and has them taught to read and write. According to the tale, the mothers mourned these children as if they had died. The tale spends a couple of pages on a triumphalist celebration of the conversion of Rus and the casting out of the devil. Eagle-eared listeners will have caught the chronicler saying, this happened in Kherson, or maybe it happened there, or other people think it happened here. In other words, even the chronicler is aware that the story he is telling about Vladimir's baptism in Kherson is not the only version around. So let's start by taking a look at what really, as far as we know, happened to Vladimir, why he decided to get baptized, and where. We have already heard one version of the conversion story last episode. In that one, the representatives of the major religions of Rus' strongest neighbours, Muslim Bulgars, Greek Orthodox, German Latin Christians, and Jewish Khazars, presented their cases to Vladimir, and he chose Greek Orthodoxy. Although this story may have had some historical basis, it's largely based on tropes. And even though Vladimir supposedly chooses Greek Orthodoxy, the tale does not have him actually converting at that point. Now we get version 2, where Vladimir decides that he will be baptized if he manages to capture Kherson, which is presented as a matter of divine favour. However, this also comes to nothing. Vladimir takes the city and does not get baptized. So then we get version 3. Vladimir demands the Byzantine princess to marry, and the Byzantines make baptism a condition of marriage. The happy couple then return to Kiev and baptize everyone else. I'm sure you will have noticed that there's not a huge amount of detail in these stories. That's mainly because the details about why Vladimir actually converted do not help the chronicler build the narrative he wants. In the real world, it is unlikely that Vladimir and the people of Rus experienced any sudden onset of devotion to Orthodoxy, and what we know of the spread of Christianity in Rus does not indicate that there was any general interest in religious education. His main motives would have been the things that we've been discussing so far, centralizing Rus and consolidating a national identity in a diverse population, and raising his international standing through marriage into the imperial family and alliance with Byzantium. Meanwhile, in Byzantium, they had their own issues to solve. Two rebellions were underway, including a major uprising led by Bardas Phocas, who was at this point threatening to blockade the Dardanelles. Emperor Basil II needed soldiers, and he asked Vladimir, since the Byzantines were used to hiring forces from neighboring allies. Vladimir agrees to help him out with the soldiers, but he wants Princess Anna for payment. Keep in mind that at this time, a born-in-the-purple Byzantine princess was the absolute pinnacle of dynastic marriages, and the King of France and the Holy Roman Emperor had already made inquiries about Anna. Being in severe need, Basil goes along with the request, but once the rebellion had been crushed, partially by good luck as Bardas Phocas collapsed and died of a seizure in the middle of challenging the emperor to single combat, he fails to deliver the princess. So, Vladimir attacks Kherson in retaliation. It's entirely possible that he takes Kherson thanks to local sympathizers helping him out, as the tale describes. Vladimir's capture of Kherson forces Basil to follow through on the deal, and Anna is sent to him along with a bunch of priests. At least that's one view. Other scholars take the view that it was the Byzantines that asked Vladimir to attack the rebellious Kherson and recover it for them, and in this case, he had already got baptized in Kiev. The key point, according to Franklin and Shepherd, is that unlike Olga, who got nothing out of the Byzantines when she refused to send them men and goods, the emperor now needs Rus more than Rus needs Byzantium. And so there's no mention of him objecting when Vladimir loots Kherson and takes some statues and relics back to Kiev. It's at this point that the tale gets a bit confused as to whether Vladimir is baptized in Kherson or Kiev, but it's clear that the baptism of Rus more generally starts in Kiev. And according to the tale, it's done by Vladimir, not missionaries from Byzantium. There's not much choice involved either. Vladimir sends out word that anyone who fails to turn up to be baptized will be considered his enemy. If we take the tale's word for this, marriage to Anna, who was the most eligible royal bride in Eurasia, may have helped give Vladimir the authority he needed to come back to Kiev and do something even more radical than his previous attempt at religion, which at least was based on local gods. However, there are Muslim records that say that it was priests from Byzantium who came and conducted the baptism. We'll get into why the tale doesn't want to say that in the second part of this episode. So with Kiev sorted, Vladimir starts sending priests out to the other cities. It's not hard to see that centralizing political role of religion here. According to the tale, Vladimir rewards Anastasius, the Hersonian priest who helped him in the siege, with the position of the first head of the Church of Rus. Again, this is minimizing any Byzantine role, especially as Anastasius actually betrayed Byzantium, and so it clearly indicates that Vladimir is remaining fully independent. Marriage into the imperial family and a bit of baptism is not going to turn him into a Byzantine vassal. This interpretation is supported by the Rus Church adopting Old Church Slavonic as its liturgical language rather than Greek. No matter how impressive those heavenly Byzantine churches were, this was a clear statement of ecclesiastical independence. It aligned the Rus Church with the Bulgarian Church, and we've already discussed how the Bulgarians attempted to make their own church as a way of reinforcing their independence from neighboring powers. It's a reasonable assumption that the rulers of Kiev knew enough about what was going on in Bulgaria to understand this for themselves, and for this to be the result of purposeful action by Vladimir. Tatishev, the early Russian historian, claimed that Vladimir had in fact asked for books and teachers from Bulgaria soon after conversion, although if you remember our previous references to him, he based some of his work on a lost chronicle that he may have made up. There is some evidence for an early Bulgarian influence in the church, but also no Bulgarian texts dating later than the beginning of the 11th century have been found. The best guess seems to be that neither the Greeks nor the Bulgarians were leading Vladimir's Rus Church. Contact with the Pope also continued. The Pope sent a mission to Kiev in 991, and Vladimir sent one back to Rome in 994. The tale's not very interested in this and goes out of its way to criticize the Latin Church. As Christian Raffensperger notes, the tale is not very interested in any kind of foreigners other than Byzantines up to this point. But once we get into the Christian era of Rus, we're going to see more of their neighbors appearing in the narrative. This also plays back into the marriage to Anna. Marrying the Byzantine princess, whose hand had been sought by the leading rulers of Europe, cemented Vladimir's place in international relations, and also the status of Rus as a major power, given that the rulers of established powers like the Holy Roman Emperor and Hungary were already competing for her hand. Anna herself makes no more appearances in the tale, and we don't know a single thing that she did in the 20 years that she spent in Kiev. She didn't even produce an heir, or any child as far as we know. But she did end up with an impressive tomb that continued to represent her prestige even after she was dead. So, while historians more or less have a consensus that the Christianization of Rus was the consequence of a political bargain between Rus and Byzantium, even if the timeline and details are still a matter of debate, let's turn now to what the chronicler was trying to tell us by the way he wrote the tale. The Byzantines had a particular version of their own conversion story enshrined in their liturgy. The original church was built by the 12 apostles and another group of 70 lesser apostles who were among those baptized with the Holy Spirit at Pentecost. These men did the initial work of spreading the gospel. But then came a 13th apostle, chosen by Christ to bring his word to the nations. Can you guess who? Yes, it was, of course, Constantine. Constantine was first recognized as an apostle by his contemporaries, such as Eusebius, a bishop and early historian of Christianity. In his Life of Constantine, he writes that the emperor built the Church of the Holy Apostles because, quote, in prospect of his own death, anticipating with an extraordinary fervor of faith, that his body would share the title with the apostles themselves. End quote. By the 6th century, so a couple of centuries after his death, he was generally recognized by the title of Equal of the Apostles. We've already encountered that title with respect to Olga of Kiev, but she received it only centuries later. There are others of whom it is used, such as the biblical Mary Magdalene, Nina of Georgia, a relative of St. George, who, according to legend, evangelized that country, and Irish patron St. Patrick. But this usage came in substantially later. In medieval times, only Constantine was equal of the apostles. Constantine had one major difference from all the original apostles. While many of them were martyred and all of them lived a life of sacrifice in hope of a reward after death, Constantine was a winner on earth. He received his empire from the King of Kings, as it says in the liturgy. You were the first to submit the royal purple to Christ, O ever memorable emperor. You willingly came to know God the King, the benefactor of all, the greatest of every authority and power. Wherefore you were granted an empire, O Christ lover, by merciful Jesus, the Saviour of our souls. Constantine's divine favour was embodied in the cross, first given to him in a vision as the sign by which he would conquer both the temporal and spiritual realms, and then the true cross, discovered by his mother in Jerusalem in 327. Every 7th of May, the churches of Constantinople and Kiev celebrated the appearance of the cross in the sky above Constantinople. In the story of the Varangian martyrs that we discussed last episode, we heard the devil rejoicing at their death and essentially declaring that Rus was his because the apostles had never preached the gospel there, even if they had enlightened the rest of the world. But, the tale says, the devil did not know that his ruin was coming. He would be expelled from the land by the true cross. This paragraph, foretelling the triumph of Christianity in Rus, quotes the Old Testament prophet Hosea, as quoted in turn by Paul in his letter to the Romans. I will call those my people who are not my people. And Psalm 19, their message has gone out into all the world. These two quotes are chanted in the liturgies for feasts of each of the 12 apostles and their equals, Constantine, Helena, Vladimir, and Olga. The chronicler is continuing to build that story of Rus' destiny that started back in his framing of Olga. If you recall, she was presented as a new Helena, the first inevitable steps towards Vladimir, the new Constantine who will bring Christianity to the peoples of Rus. But if Vladimir was a pagan idol builder with a harem of 800 dubiously consenting women, how could he fulfill this holy role? That's right, by undergoing a spiritual transformation, just like Constantine had, a transformation modeled on that of the 12th apostle, Paul. If you're familiar with the story of Paul, or did last episode's homework, you will have picked up on one more parallel already. But let's quickly go through it. Selections from the biblical recounting are included in the liturgies for the feasts of Constantine and Helena. Paul was a non-believer and persecutor of Christians who experienced a vision of Christ. Constantine was also a non-believer, a representative of an institution that persecuted Christians, and he also experienced the vision of Christ. The liturgy makes the comparison explicit in several places with phrases like, Christ God caught you from heaven just as he did Paul of old. Constantine heeds the divine message, and God's power grants him victory over his enemies. Constantine became the equal of the apostles because he was a new Paul, the apostle who was not one of the original apostles. He was chosen by God in the same way that Paul had been, to carry on Paul's mission, which was to bring the gospel to the Gentiles. The chroniclers have created a narrative of the conversion of the Rus in the tale of bygone years that gives Vladimir the same role. And so, to pick on just one aspect, Vladimir could not be an obedient student baptized by a spiritually superior Greek, as Olga had been on her visit to Constantinople. Instead, his conversion also had to be the result of direct divine intervention, and he had to undergo a transformative experience. And so we have pagan Vladimir persecuting Christians while God begins to pursue him. The Greek who visits Kiev to advocate for Orthodox Christianity gets to lay out an expansive case compared to the brief paragraph his competitors receive. Then Vladimir's emissaries to Byzantium are transported to heaven by its churches. But this is not enough to persuade him. Like Paul and Constantine, he needs his own experience. The next stage of the story takes place during the Siege of Kherson. This too is a parallel to the story of Constantine, who received his divine vision and the sign of the cross that would bring him victory in battle. That is, Constantine receives not merely a philosophical proof of God, but empirical proof of God, through God bringing him victory. From out of nowhere into the stalemate of the siege, an arrow arrives into Vladimir's camp from God's representative, the priest Anastasius, telling Vladimir how to take the city. Vladimir knows where it comes from and declares, "If these instructions prove successful, I will be baptized. If God brings victory, then obviously God is the true God." But although Vladimir takes the city, he does not immediately get baptized, and therefore he is divinely punished by being deprived of his vision, just as Paul had been. In the biblical story, Paul is blinded when he receives his vision on the road to Damascus. God speaks to a local Christian, Ananias, and tells him to go to Paul and restore his sight. Ananias objects because he knows Paul as a persecutor of Christians, but God tells him that he has chosen Paul, and so Ananias goes, lays hands on Paul, scales fall from his eyes, and he is baptized. In the tale, Vladimir has also been divinely blinded. In place of Ananias, Anna of Byzantium is unwillingly sent to baptize and marry him. Anna tells him that baptism will restore his sight, and he responds that if this is true, then the God of the Christians is truly great. As soon as hands are laid on him for the baptism, Vladimir's sight is restored. Once again, God's power has been proven. There are numerous hymns in the liturgy that present these blindings as a transformative experience that gives Paul and Vladimir special insight. Vladimir states, "Now I have known the true God," and the tale completely changes its presentation of him. There is no more womanizing warrior, the kind of person who would trick his brother in order to kill him. Vladimir is now a holy king, ready to cast the devil out of Rus. Vladimir, who the tale has already called a church builder, starts almost as soon as he emerges from the baptismal waters by building a church right there in Kherson. And then he gets everything together that he will need to convert Kiev: icons, relics, and clerical instruments. But as Sean Griffin emphasizes in The Liturgical Past in Byzantium and Early Rus, he does not take one important thing. He does not take a bishop, the only person the Byzantine tradition allows to consecrate a new church. This is going to the parallels with Constantine again. According to Eusebius, Constantine had told his bishops, "You are the bishops of the things inside the church. I am a bishop appointed by God to the things outside it." Byzantine hymns called Constantine the priest and king who established the Church of God. So when Vladimir heads back to Kiev and starts baptizing people and consecrating churches by himself, rather than having a Byzantine bishop do it, the chronicler is putting Vladimir on the same level as St. Constantine, next to the apostles. In other words, Vladimir is not only the king who leads Rus to Christianity, he is the father of the Rus Church. To support this interpretation, Sean Griffin finds numerous direct quotes from the Byzantine liturgy, with the words usually said by the bishop at a baptism or consecration put into Vladimir's mouth, concluding by asking God to confirm his people in the true faith and save them from the intrigues of the evil one. The passages mirror the earlier parts with Olga. There, the patriarch played the baptizer, and Olga was naturally the baptized student. Now, Vladimir takes the priestly role. You've probably also noted the devil's role running through all of this. First, as the devil celebrates the deaths of the Varangian Christians because he does not understand that Vladimir will, as the equal of the apostles, drive him out. Then, as he realizes that Vladimir has driven him out of Rus. If you recall from the episode on Olga, the Orthodox baptismal service they were using here contained 15 renunciations of Satan, which added up in the ceremony led by Vladimir to casting the devil out of the people of Rus. As Griffin emphasizes, this Vladimir as priest is not the actual historical Vladimir. The historical Vladimir is dispensed with in the phrases about some say this happened here and some say it happened there. The chronicler is not interested in where Vladimir was baptized or by whom, because his Vladimir is the Holy Father of Christian Rus. But the invention of Vladimir the Saint and Father of Holy Rus did not end with the tale of bygone years. In fact, it's still with us today, an ongoing process with real-world effects. After hearing how the tale's narrative enshrines Vladimir as the father of Rus, you might be surprised to hear that the first national commemoration of the baptism of Rus, and therefore of Vladimir in this role, took place only in 1888. The celebration was a major affair. Events kicked off on the feast day of St. Olga, July 11th, and continued through several other saints associated with early Rus Christianity. On St. Vladimir's Day, 28th of July, 100,000 people, including thousands from across Russia and guests from other Slavic and Orthodox countries, and even Britain and Japan, gathered in Kiev to watch a procession carry a cross down to the Dnieper. By this point, celebrating the day of baptism had become a local tradition in Kiev, and it was Kievans who initially proposed the celebration, with Metropolitan of Kiev, Platon, sending a proposal for a national event based in Kiev to the Synod of the Russian Orthodox Church. But that was not what turned it into a national festival. The driving force for that came from Russian imperial ideology, still trying to use religion to create a single united people. In this case, not uniting the multi-ethnic pagans of Vladimir's day, but combining Great Russians, Ukrainians, or Little Russians, as they were called then, and White Russians into a single ethnically united people under an Orthodox Tsar. A large area inhabited by Eastern Slavs lay outside of what had formed as Russia during the rise of Muscovy. So when the empire acquired these territories, it used imperial histories looking to Rus and to the idea of Russia as its successor in a continuous line of development to unify these lands and assert their common origin. and therefore common future. If you recall the episode on the Norman controversy, you'll know that there were already debates around Rus and the origins of Russians and Ukrainians. 30 years before the 900th anniversary of the baptism of Rus, the 1000th anniversary of the summoning of the Varangians, had been accompanied by arguments over whether Russian history began with Rurik and the Scandinavians in Novgorod, or with the Slavs around Kiev. Some even questioned whether Russians and Ukrainians both originated from Rus. Historians and journalists heatedly debated whether the ancestors of the Ukrainians had always lived there, or whether they were later arrivals, replacements for Russians that had been driven off into the northeast by Mongols. Another facet of these debates was Ukrainians who sought their own place in the empire, an important place, one that recognized their great contribution and gave them the privileges due to the most ancient element of the nation. This meant that both those who asserted the distinctiveness of Ukrainians and those who wanted to subsume all the separate Slavic identities into one Russian super-identity had an interest in promoting Vladimir and the day of baptism. The actual distinctiveness of real-life Ukrainians and the growing Ukrainian national consciousness were hard to reconcile with the Russian imperial project, and these competing interests shaped the development of the celebration plans. The initial plan submitted by Metropolitan Platon was drafted by Feofan Lebedintsev. Lebedintsev was the editor of Kievskaya Starina, a historical, ethnographic, and literary journal that for the 25 years of its existence played a major role in the development of Ukrainian culture, and brother of the Metropolitan's close ally, the Dean of St. Sophia Cathedral. While the plan calls for promoting the cult of Vladimir across the empire, the actual celebrations in Kiev focused on celebrating Ukrainian heroes like Petr Mogila and Cossack leaders Petro Konashevich Sahaidichny and Bohdan Khmelnytsky, as well as Kiev's role in Holy Rus. This raised concerns among other leaders, including Pobedonostsev, the notoriously reactionary statesman who had in 1880 become Oberprokurator of the Most Holy Synod, a position from which he supervised the Russian Orthodox Church as its effective head. He decided that the celebration should limit itself to religious aspects rather than political ones. The last thing he wanted was that an event intended to reinforce all Russian unity would end up playing into the hands of Ukrainian nationalists. As it was, the festivities opened on St. Olga's Day with the unveiling of a monument to Bohdan Khmelnytsky, whom the committee behind the monument called the continuer of Vladimir's work, who had restored the unity of Rus by liberating it from Poland. Metropolitan Platon called him a defender of orthodoxy and the Russian nation. Others took up the refrain, asserting that orthodoxy, even more than blood ties, was what united Little Rus and Great Rus. Meanwhile, the police were finding copies of a pamphlet entitled Kiev the Day Before the Feast of St. Vladimir, circulated in the city by some people calling themselves the Committee for the Rebirth of Great Ukraine. The writers castigated the oppression and Russification of the Ukrainian people, derided Russians as Orthodox Tatars, and called for the liberation of Ukrainians like the Balkan Slavs had been liberated from the Ottomans a few years earlier. Tempers were rising. The Metropolitan was trying to bail out of further participation, and city police were concerned that demonstrations were about to break out. Pobedonosov moved to defuse the situation by imposing a Moscow-centric interpretation of the baptism of Rus on the rest of the festivities. He arrived in Kiev with a clear plan to control what was said at the official celebrations, in sermons and in speeches. The Metropolitan hosted a gathering where historian Ivan Malyshevsky, a specialist on the tale of bygone years, discoursed on how Vladimir had united the Slavs through the adoption of Orthodoxy, referring to Russia and Ukraine as a single nation that had been divided and suffered under Polish occupation, but was now united under an Orthodox Tsar. After the procession of the cross to the banks of the Dnieper, the city Duma held a lunch, where Pobedonosov himself set out a vision of Kiev as the starting point of the triumph of Muscovite autocracy. In a series of toasts running throughout the meal, he declared that God had miraculously gathered the Slavs through Kiev from a primitive people into a great state led by Moscow. He claimed that the baptism of Rus by Vladimir was the only time a leader of his people had brought his people into the church peacefully and without bloodshed. Autocracy had grown together with the church as an unbreakable tandem, strengthening and preserving the state integrity of Russia. No credit went to Kiev for this, as Pobedonosov didn't mention it again. It was Moscow, the great daughter of the great mother and heart of Russia, around which all Russian Slavs were united. His speeches were transmitted across the empire and reprinted. The celebration sparked discussions around Vladimir's legacy across Russia. Somewhat surprisingly, everyone agreed that he had made the best choice in Orthodoxy, but there were significant differences over why. Conservatives argued that Orthodoxy had given Russia the basis for forming a distinct civilization that avoided whatever they thought was wrong with Western Europe, usually something to do with liberalism, and also provided a beacon for all Slavs to look towards. Like Pobedonosov, they emphasized the peaceful way Christianization was carried out, which meant that Russia had not experienced the conflict between the church and secular authorities that characterized so much of Western history. In Russia, they said, there was no disagreement between church, popular, and state interests. Liberals drew essentially the opposite conclusion. The defining advantage of the Christianization of Rus was that it bound Russians into a European path of development. The baptism of Rus should be celebrated for joining Russia to the supposedly European Christian world, not for creating a separate Russian world. These are positions that we will encounter again. The next major national celebration of the baptism of Rus came in the Soviet Union at the 1000th anniversary in 1988. Once again, it was the result of coinciding but disparate interests. The church had begun thinking about how it would be marking the date back in 1980, appointing a committee chaired by the Patriarch, Pimen, to plan the arrangements. The expectation was that it would be a strictly church event. The Soviet Union under Leonid Brezhnev was still a staunchly atheist state where religion was only tolerated to the extent that it served the state's interests. But as the 1980s went on, things were beginning to change. In 1983, the state returned the Danilov Monastery to the church. It had been the last monastery that the Bolsheviks shut down, and then it had been repurposed for use as an NKVD detention center. Now it became the first to be returned as the new headquarters of the Russian Orthodox Church and the residence of the Patriarch. American listeners might be interested to hear that the monastery's bells was saved by the American industrialist Charles R. Crane. The Bolsheviks' practice was to melt church bells down, not just for the metal, which was often valuable, but also as an act particularly offensive to the Russian Orthodox Church, which considers bells to be on a similar level to icons and the ringing of the bells to be a symbolic proclamation of the gospel. Crane donated the bells to Harvard University, but in 2008 they were returned to Russia and rehung in Danilov Monastery. Initially, monks were not permitted to return to the monastery, but following the death of Konstantin Chernenko, official objections were dropped. When Gorbachev took power, the state's position on religion was loosened even more. The media reported on religious persecution alongside other previously banned subjects, and the church once again began to be presented as the guardian of national culture. The state saw the 1000th anniversary as a chance to demonstrate its commitment to the new openness. The church was given the right to use other significant churches, including the Monastery of the Caves in Kiev and the Moscow Kremlin cathedrals, and plans were made for celebrations that would include wider society. On 12th June 1988, the official reopening of Danilov Monastery was celebrated with visiting foreign church leaders, including the patriarchs of Antioch, Bulgaria, Romania, Jerusalem, and the Archbishop of Cyprus. One person who didn't come was the Ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople. Celebrations were held in every eparchy or diocese of the Russian Orthodox Church, with bigger events in Moscow, Leningrad, Novgorod, Kiev, Minsk, and Vladimir, concerts at the Bolshoi, and national TV coverage. A special Vladimir the Great 25-ruble coin was minted, which was appropriate as Vladimir was also the first Rus ruler to issue coinage. But somewhat surprisingly, peak Vladimir was still ahead, in the post-Soviet 21st century of independent Ukraine and the Russian Federation. One manifestation of this has been a proliferation of statues of Vladimir. The first appeared in 1853 on what is now Volodymyr Hill, overlooking the Dnieper in Kiev. The idea of building the monument had appeared a couple of decades earlier under Tsar Nicholas I. Strange as it may seem to a modern Western perspective, statues of saints were controversial in the Russian Empire. The Orthodox Church does not make figures of saints, it has icons instead. And the traditional method of commemorating significant people was to build a church or chapel dedicated to their name, not put up a monument. Like so many other things, the idea of commemorating public figures with statues was introduced to Russia by Peter I. Public monuments with a religious aspect remain controversial in more conservative church circles to this day. So, despite being built in the middle of the 19th century, the statue of Saint Volodymyr became the first sculptural monument in Kiev and one of the symbols of the city. The statue is in a pseudo-Byzantine style and stands over 20 meters tall. Vladimir was also part of the Millennium of Russia monument in Novgorod, and has a statue in the Kazan Cathedral in St. Petersburg. But the Kiev statue was the only dedicated monument to St. Vladimir anywhere in the Russian Empire or Soviet Union until Perestroika. At the same time as the statue was built, the St. Vladimir University was also built in Kiev, and then a decade later, the St. Vladimir Cathedral, all part of the imperial project of reinforcing Kiev's place as an ancient and original part of Russia, pushing out the remaining Polish influences and Russifying the Ukrainian people. The millennium of the baptism of Rus was a natural time to think of commemorating Vladimir, and a new statue was installed in the grounds of the Danilov Monastery. But while the high imperial narrative of Russian history saw Vladimir as a figure capable of unifying Russia and Ukraine, the identity problems of the post-Soviet era would be rather different. In 1993, a statue of Vladimir was installed in Sevastopol by Vyacheslav Klykov, the sculptor who produced the Belgorod statue of Sviatoslav that we've already mentioned, the one that caused a storm of anti-Semitic controversy. That was not his first encounter with controversy. In 1987, he had wanted to erect a statue of Sergius of Radonezh, one of the Russian Orthodox Church's most important saints in the Moscow region. The authorities obstructed the statue for a year, but then let it go ahead. He had wanted to put a statue to Nicholas II on Borovitskaya Square, a place we will soon be hearing more about, but that didn't work out and it ended up in a village called Tyninskoye, where it was blown up by anarchists. And communists were incensed by his plans to put up a statue to Civil War era white leader Admiral Kolchak in Irkutsk. Vladimir's statues sprouted all over post-Soviet Russia. In Belgorod, where local historians misread the tale of bygone years to claim that Vladimir had founded the city. In Vladimir, where the local authorities decided that it had been founded by Vladimir in 990, rather than Vladimir Monomakh in 1108, as people had thought for the previous centuries. The millennium of Vladimir's death in 2015 triggered another round of statue building. Most were initiated by regional Orthodox nationalists or Orthodox nationalist artists with a personal mission. Some were erected by corporations or public organizations. The purpose of these monuments and others like them was in some ways the inverse of the 900th anniversary commemoration in Kiev. While those celebrations tried to place Rus within Russian history and make Kiev a Russian city and its rulers Russian rulers, now the aim was to transpose Rus history into Russia itself. Much of Rus was now in independent Ukraine or Belarus. Russia has so far been unable to adapt to a version of Rus that is part of a common past but which it does not own. It's all or nothing, so if Russia does not have Ukraine, Ukraine cannot have Rus. The St. Vladimir statue building culminated in the monument to Vladimir the Great, opened in 2016 on Borovitskaya Square, next to the Kremlin. Another tasteless, grandiose sculpture that threatened to cost the Kremlin its UNESCO World Heritage status, even if it's not such a blight on the Moscow skyline as the awful Peter the Great statue not far away on Moscow River. This Vladimir holds a massive cross in one hand and a sword in the other. But while all this statue building was a symbol of what Orthodox nationalists were doing with Vladimir in Russia, there was still the question of what the Church was doing with Vladimir in Ukraine. After all, the Russian Orthodox Church, which, irrespective of the genuine faith of ordinary believers, is a corrupt institution headed by former KGB agents deeply entwined with the Russian state, still included Ukraine within its ecclesiastical territory. For fairness, I should note that many scholars argue that the Russian Orthodox Church did not become the compliant tool of the state it is often seen to be, quite rightly in my opinion, given its role over the last few years and in the current war, until the later Putin period. It has been argued that it had a weak connection to the state and its own agenda during the 90s and Putin's first two terms. not being an expert, but based on my own experience living in Russia in the 90s and early 2000s, I think there is a fair amount of truth in that. Yeltsin was too much of an irreligious old communist to really find that much time for the church. But on the other hand, I think that the church's main agenda in that period was exactly to bind itself back into the state as strongly as possible, and return Orthodoxy to its place as the linchpin of Russian identity. And as we will see here, the church has been pushing imperialistic propaganda for years. Problems in the church developed in parallel to the restoration of political freedoms in the Soviet Union, because the centrifugal forces that were unleashed in perestroika also affected the churches in the Soviet republics that were itching to break away. The current leader of the Russian Orthodox Church, Patriarch Kirill, was an archbishop at the time and was appointed head of the church's Department of International Relations in 1989. Putting him right in the middle of what was about to kick off. Some of the people who were asking why Ukraine or Estonia or any other republic should stay part of the Soviet Union were also asking why their nation's church should remain part of a Russian Orthodox church that had served imperialism and Russification for centuries. Just as Orthodoxy sought to make itself a key part of identity for Russians, it tried to do the same in these places, which meant it was forming an identity that was not the national identity, and maybe even was at odds with the national identity. The first steps to an independent church were taken in Western Ukraine, when a parish in Lviv exited the jurisdiction of the Moscow Patriarch and declared that it was reviving the Ukrainian autocephalous Orthodox Church. Autocephalous literally means self-headed and is used to designate an independent Orthodox Church. Short-lived previous attempts had been made to create this church in Ukraine in 1921 and 1942, and some had tried to keep the dream alive in exile in the United States and Canada. Shortly after, the Estonian Apostolic Orthodox Church declared that it had left the jurisdiction of the Moscow Patriarch and returned to that of the Ecumenical Patriarch in Istanbul. As head of the Department of International Relations, Kirill was the man in charge of countering this trend, and his main opponent, naturally, came from Ukraine. Metropolitan Filaret of Kiev and all Ukraine was the head of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, which was aligned with the Moscow Patriarchate. He was a leading hierarch of the Russian Orthodox Church. When Patriarch Pimen died, Filaret stood in his place until the new patriarch was chosen and was considered one of the prime candidates. He was also accused of collaborating with the KGB. He defended himself by saying that every bishop had to deal with the KGB, but claimed that he had been aligned with the Politburo, while Alexei, who was chosen as the patriarch, belonged to the KGB. Reports also claimed that he had a wife and three children, but these kinds of stories were run-of-the-mill in the post-Soviet 90s. In April 1992, he attended a church council in Moscow and submitted an official request for complete canonical autocephaly, that is, independence. The Holy Synod predictably rejected the request, accused him of causing schism, and demanded that he resign. Under pressure at the council, Filaret agreed, but once he had returned to Kiev, he refused to step down. The Moscow Patriarch had stripped him of his holy orders, so Filaret and his supporters formed the Ukrainian Orthodox Church Kiev Patriarchate, of which he was elected patriarch in 995. And then the Russian Orthodox Church, anathematized him. He would not be restored to communion until 2018. The Russian Orthodox Church treated the breakaway Kiev Patriarchate as a self-appointed group with no legitimacy, while the Kiev Patriarchate declined to acknowledge that Moscow had any authority over it, or indeed the church in Ukraine generally. As Filaret pointed out, the church had come to Moscow from Kiev, not the other way around, and therefore Kiev is the mother church. Speaking to the Ukrainian parliament in 1997, he said that anyone against the Ukrainian Orthodox Church should be considered the enemy of Ukraine and a traitor to the Ukrainian state. Back in the Russian Orthodox Church, Kirill had highlighted nationalism as the main threat to the church since the early 1990s, not just in terms of the church splintering, but also in terms of the former Soviet Union continuing to break apart into even smaller units. A new idea to replace communism and unite the people was needed, and the church was presenting orthodoxy as that idea. But the idea was poorly articulated and failed to gain much traction. Things began to change in the mid-2000s when what became known as the Color Revolutions aimed to take former republics further out of Russia's orbit. Ukraine's Orange Revolution erupted in late 2004 after Viktor Yanukovych tried to rig the presidential election. The Supreme Court cancelled the results and ordered a revote, and the international attention that the protests had attracted helped ensure that a fair election was conducted, resulting in the victory of Viktor Yushchenko, running on a program of strengthening Western ties. The election was a major turning point in post-Soviet Ukrainian-Russian relations, and according to Sean Griffin in his article, Revolution, Raskol, and Rock and Roll, the 1020th anniversary of the day of the baptism of Rus, Raskol, by the way, is the Russian word for schism, quote, the Orange Revolution was ultimately responsible for more than a change in Ukrainian leadership. It was also responsible for a major shift in the Russian political propaganda surrounding Saint Prince Vladimir the Great. From this time forward, in the public rhetoric promulgated by both church and state, Vladimir began to be employed as the symbol of a resurgent transnational political ideology, one that aimed to restore the primordial unity of the East Slav peoples, which was said to stretch back in time from the Soviet Union through the Great Russian Empire to the ancient land of Rus. End quote. Moscow Patriarch Alexei had sent a message to the people of Ukraine before the revote, telling them that they were about to determine the fate of nations for years, decades, and centuries. He appealed to them in the name of their fellow believers in Russia, Belarus, Moldova, and what he called the other countries belonging to the United Orthodox tradition of Holy Rus, born in the Kievan baptismal font. One wrong step, he said, could destroy centuries of unity shared by brotherly Slavic peoples, bound by one faith, one destiny, and one history. Ukraine took that step, but for the Patriarch, it didn't actually change anything. A couple of days after the election, he repeated, "The Orthodox faith unites us all, since we have all come out of the Kievan baptismal font." He met with Yushchenko and told him the same thing. Ukraine was making its choice for independence and anti-imperialism, and all the church could find to oppose it was the same old Russian paternalism and spiritual kinship based on the story of Vladimir and the baptism of Rus. The church took steps to promote the cult of Vladimir, including submitting a letter to Yushchenko asking for Saints' Day to be established as a national holiday. plans began to be made to make the 1000th and 20th anniversary in 2008 a major celebration. Patriarch Alexei and Metropolitan Volodymyr of Kiev organized a concert tour of Orthodox inclined rock bands, and Vladimir Putin announced that he would like to be involved in a worthy celebration of the event. Yushchenko kept quiet for now, jumping in on the side of Filaret and the Kiev Patriarchate risked exacerbating divisions in Ukrainian society. But the Patriarch and other Ukrainian nationalists were strongly opposed to letting Russia claim ownership of Rus. They began planning their own celebrations under the title of the Day of the Baptism of Kievan Rus, Ukraine. The Ukrainian Church had a potential ally against the Moscow Patriarchate, the Ecumenical Patriarchate of Constantinople. While Moscow claimed to have the right to grant a tomos, the ecclesiastical decree that determines whether a church is independent, the Ecumenical Patriarchate asserted that it could also do so. The collapse of the Soviet Union had also led the Patriarch, Bartholomew I, to take an interest in rebuilding historical ties with the churches of the newly independent countries, churches that Moscow saw as lying in its jurisdiction. 2 months before the commemoration, Yushchenko met with a delegation from Istanbul, and afterwards issued a statement saying that Ukraine needed to strengthen its ties to the Mother Church of the Patriarchate of Constantinople. The delegation returned home carrying an invitation to the event. It was a shot across the bows of the Moscow Patriarchate. The Ecumenical Patriarch accepted his invitation, and the commemoration transformed from the Russian Orthodox Church trying to enforce its vision of the unity of Russians and Ukrainians through its construction of St. Vladimir into something else entirely. Potentially, it could mark the Ukrainian Church switching to Moscow's biggest rival. Leaving aside the political side of Russian-Ukrainian relations for a moment, is a few figures to help you understand what the Russian Orthodox Church was fighting for. In 2008, the Church claimed to have 29,000 parishes, but of that amount, only 14,000 were in Russia itself, and 11,000 were in Ukraine, under the control of the Moscow-affiliated Ukrainian Orthodox Church. So the Russian Orthodox Church was not merely risking a split. If the breakaway churches united, they could knock Moscow off its pedestal as leader of the largest Orthodox Church in the world. Patriarch Bartholomew arrived in Kiev looking like he was there on a mission. He steps off the plane and declared that he was there to pray for the unification of all Orthodox Christians into a single church. He visited the monuments of Saints Vladimir and Olga and laid flowers. In the evening, he preached a sermon at the Cathedral of St. Sophia, built by Byzantine artisans for Vladimir's son, Yaroslav. The main event took place on the square in front of the cathedral the next day. Yushchenko declared that the new holiday was a festival of Christianity and European civilization, celebrating the 1000-year history of Ukraine. He closed by turning to Bartholomew and asking him to bless a national local church in Ukraine. Bartholomew's response made the case for intervening. He presented a version of the Baptism of Rus, which Vladimir played no role beyond acquiescing to the conversion. Instead, it was Byzantine missionaries who did the baptizing. The Christianization of Rus was not an event creating a holy brotherhood of the East Slavs. It was part of Constantinople's mission to bring salvation to Eastern Europe, one that tied Ukraine to its mother church, the Ecumenical Patriarchate. According to Bartholomew, the Ecumenical Patriarchate had been forced to surrender the Ukrainian church to the Moscow Patriarchate, against Ukrainian wishes, after Peter I annexed Ukraine. It had agreed to this sacrifice to do what was best for Ukrainians, and therefore it was right for the Ecumenical Patriarchate to do what was best for Ukrainians again. Restoring the unity of the Church, he said, supersedes any political goals. But you'll notice that he did not give President Yushchenko what he asked for. Patriarch Kirill landed in Kiev the same day to a rather different reception. He was greeted at the airport by Metropolitan Volodymyr and Viktor Yanukovych, but there were crowds of Ukrainian believers there to meet him when he arrived at the Monastery of the Caves. Someone had even helpfully supplied them with signs with slogans such as "Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, this is Holy Rus." The next day was Sunday, and the two patriarchs were to celebrate a live televised service together at the monument to St. Volodymyr. Bartholomew spoke first. Once again, his Vladimir was just one of the kind people who helped Byzantine missionaries bring Christianity to Eastern Europe, where they supposedly continued spreading the word across all Rus throughout the 11th century. Baptism, he said, had joined the people of Rus not only to Orthodoxy, but united them with Byzantium. Alexei followed. His story had no Byzantine missionaries and no place for Constantinople. Instead, Saint equal to the Apostles Vladimir had enlightened Rus, and the light of his baptism had been spread from the Baltic to the Far East, from the Northern Seas to the deserts of Central Asia, expanding and building a distinct Christian civilization. Russia had long since ceased to be ecclesiastically subordinate to Constantinople. Vladimir's church had become the true center of Orthodoxy, and the fact that the vicissitudes of history meant that Holy Rus had moved its spiritual center from Kiev to Vladimir to Moscow to St. Petersburg changed nothing. Kiev remained one of its most important centers. Ukrainians didn't hear any of this, as their TV stopped broadcasting as soon as Alexei opened his mouth. We like to think of things as being good versus evil, lies versus truth, but I think any long-term listeners of this podcast should be able to tell that both patriarchs were delivering tendentious and self-serving speeches with little care for actual history. And the reason Bartholomew hadn't given Yushchenko the blessing he was looking for was that he was actually here to see Alexei. With the service finished, the pair headed off to the Monastery of the Caves for a few hours of private talks and came out agreeing that they were all responsible for Orthodox unity and ensuring that the divisions in the Ukrainian Church needed to be resolved according to the canonical path. For over a century, the Ecumenical Patriarchy had been trying to arrange a great and holy council that would bring together all the autocephalous Orthodox churches of the world for the first time. World wars, revolutions, and the Iron Curtain had defeated their efforts. Ukraine turned out to be just the bargaining chip that would buy the support of the Russian Orthodox Church. But events continued to develop. Alexei died and Kirill became the new patriarch. In 2010, Russia approved a new holiday, this time titled the Day of the Baptism of Rus. Yushchenko lost the next election to Yanukovych, this time fairly, and the 1025th anniversary in 2013 drew near. This time around, Russia dominated the official commemorations. Even Vladimir Putin was there on his last visit to Ukraine. He told the crowd, quote, "We have gathered here today at this Dnieper baptismal font, at this Kievan font where the choice was made for all of Holy Rus. Our ancestors who lived in these territories made this choice for all of our people. We have no right to forget this brotherhood. We are obliged to keep the traditions of our ancestors. Patriarch Kirill followed up, quote, "It is the Russian Orthodox Church that, like a mother, has protected the spiritual values chosen by Prince Vladimir, and which has protected the spiritual unity of those who called themselves and who continue to call themselves the followers of Saint Prince Vladimir." End quote. The next day, it was Patriarch Filaret's turn to lead members of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church Kiev Patriarchate in a service at the same spot. He spoke against the Russian reading of the past and closed, quote, "Therefore may our Lord Jesus Christ, through the prayers of the Holy Equal of the Apostles, Prince Volodymyr, unite our Orthodox Church and strengthen our Ukrainian state, so that our Ukrainian state may enter the European Union, just as the Holy Equal of the Apostles, Prince Volodymyr, once entered Europe." You already know what happened next. 4 months later, the Euromaidan protests started. The Yanukovych regime collapsed. Then came the Revolution of Dignity, Russian annexation of Crimea, and fighting in the Donbass and Luhansk. There were no joint commemorations to mark the 1030th anniversary in 2018. In Moscow, thousands followed Putin and Patriarch Kirill from the Kremlin's Cathedral Square out to the statue of Vladimir on Borovitskaya Square, where Putin told them that the baptism of Rus was the starting point of the formation and development of Russian statehood, the spiritual birth of their ancestors, and the determining factor in their identity and self-consciousness. Meanwhile, in Kyiv, President Petro Poroshenko and Filaret spoke to their own crowd at the statue of Vladimir, where Poroshenko told them that 1,000 years ago, Saint Equal of the Apostles, Prince Vladimir, had made a choice to join Christianity and to join Europe. Then, on Christmas Day 2018, Poroshenko and Yushchenko stood in St. George's Cathedral in Istanbul and watched Patriarch Bartholomew hand the Thomas of Autocephaly to Metropolitan Epiphany, the new head of the Orthodox Church of Ukraine. The Russian Orthodox Church refused, of course, to recognize the new church and officially severed communion with the Ecumenical Patriarchate, a move which is compared to the Great Schism between Catholicism and Orthodoxy. Many of you will be familiar with the term historiography. History podcasters like to review the historiography and discuss how the significance or meaning of events changes with time, or how perceptions can differ from actual events as narratives are constructed to meet the changing needs of different generations. I do it too in this podcast, although I try to incorporate it more into the general flow rather than picking it out. Vladimir is an almost perfect example of the difference between historicity and historiography. We know that he officially adopted Christianity as the state religion of Rus, and no one can contest that this was a key event in the development of Rus and Eastern Europe generally. But as you've heard in this episode, not only do we barely know anything about how it happened, we don't know for sure where he was baptized, or by whom, or why exactly he chose to be baptized. But from the tale of bygone years down to Russia and Ukraine today, no one really seems to be interested in the mere facts. Whatever the true story of the baptism of Rus, Vladimir did not simply turn into a saint overnight and then personally baptize the people, as the tale would have it. He did not choose to make Rus European. Byzantium was not a European empire, and at the time there were more Christians in Africa and Asia than there were in Europe. He also did not do it to create a separate civilization to which all Slavs must belong whether they want to or not, because even if it wasn't joining Europe, it was still joining the wider Christian world, a world with which the Rus maintained close ties. As Sean Griffin concludes, quote, "It remains unclear which version of the medieval prince will emerge victorious, Saint Volodymyr the Ukrainian nationalist, or Saint Vladimir the Russian imperialist." Amid such uncertainty, however, there is at least one aspect of the memory wars which raises few doubts. No matter what may happen in the future, the historical baptizer of Rus, the half-Slav, half-Varangian barbarian, who bartered his salvation for the hand of a Byzantine princess and never dreamed of the modern-day states of Russia or Ukraine, that Vladimir shall remain long forgotten. End quote. Around a month ago, at the time of writing, Vladimir Putin and Patriarch Kirill once again led a crowd from a service in the Kremlin's Dormition Cathedral down to the statue of Vladimir on Borovitskaya Square. There would be no joint commemoration of the 1035th anniversary of the baptism of Rus. Thanks to them and their imperialist obsessions, there may never be a joint celebration again. Instead, the ritual they invented less than a decade ago is now passed off as some kind of ancient Russian tradition. Elsewhere, relics of Vladimir and Alexander Nevsky of Novgorod were carried by sea to the ruins of Hersonese, which has now replaced the Kievan font as the birthplace of Russian Orthodoxy in their propaganda. Patriarch Kirill spoke once again, repeating the same message that he has been preaching for over two decades. If Vladimir had not baptized Rus, there would have been neither Rus, nor Russia, nor the great Russian Empire, nor contemporary Russia. For him, they are clearly all the same thing, and this is why he and those who think like him have gone to war. Misguided Western observers have often accused Putin and his cronies of wanting to restore the Soviet Union. I hope this episode will help you understand that that's not true. Putin is no communist and has often derided aspects of the Soviet Union. It's the Russian Empire, especially the allegedly Holy Rus of a united Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus, that he wants to restore. But join me next episode as we return to Rus and see the real Vladimir build his kingdom. Thank you for listening, and until next time, goodbye.